Today, 2 hours of news, current affairs, and opinion, brought to you by Beyond Beijing. With in-depth panel discussions on domestic and global issues, Today brings you the story behind the headlines. Locally produced, but with a distinctly international flavor. Today.
You're listening to Today on Beyond Beijing. I'm Paul James.
And I'm Zhao Yang. Today's big debate is on EU economy as the European Central Bank cut interest rate to a new record low.
And of course, following the big debate, Xu Qindo and John Artman will be in for the second half in the Global Talk. In our world headlines, we'll be discussing the United States and Russia agreeing to an international meeting connected to Syria. Egypt has reshuffled its cabinet. A Brazilian diplomat has become the new head of the WTO. Somalia gaining military and cash assistance at a meeting in London.
And our China report brings us a China response to U.S. report on Chinese military developments. 21 Chongqing officials have been punished over sex video. Beijing plans to raise taxi drivers' income. And a 13-year-old girl kills her classmate out of jealousy.
But before all that, let's get into our big debate. Well, the latest stats highlighting somewhat dire figures facing the EU economy. Greece poised to cut more state positions. Spain recording its highest unemployment rate ever, 27%. France in some dire situation as well. UK economy growing a little bit, 0.3% through the first quarter of this year, but overall growth in the UK economy remaining sluggish. Italy, the third largest economy in the Eurozone, seeing a new government form finally, based on a grand coalition between the center-left and the center-right political box. At the same time, we're seeing squabbles emerge between the IMF and the European Central Bank and Germany. All of this leading to, well, shall we say, interesting times economically in the Eurozone. So, to that end, we will be discussing what is happening economically on the continent in Europe.
So today we're talking in the studio with Cao Can, CEO of Shengya Capital. And also join us on the phone are Mike Bastian, researcher at Nottingham University School of Contemporary Chinese Studies, and also Uri Dadush, senior associate and director of the Carnegie Endowments International Economics Program.
All right, well, let's start it off in studio with Cao Can. First off, first blush assessment. Is Europe's economy in as bad a state as many people believe it is, or are things potentially looking to get better?
Well, I think things are getting better now in Europe. They're going through a restructuring process. So they're dealing with the pain instead of kicking the can down the road, because the bond market is asking them to, you know, reduce their deficit. So when you reduce deficit, you have to cut a lot of jobs. So there will be some pain when they go through this restructuring process. But once the process is finished, they will be in a better place to start their economic growth again.
Now, Mike Bastian from Nottingham University, Cao Can just mentioned bonds, and we just got news this morning that Portugal has managed to sell off its first batch of 10-year bonds since getting its bailout a couple of years ago, and they're really touting this as a big sort of success, and that the Portuguese economy is starting to come back. I mean, the bond yield was very close to 6%, but in the same respect, I mean, is that a furtherance of what Cao Can was talking about?
I'm afraid not. I'm afraid I don't share Cao Can's optimism at all. I think austerity has failed miserably and is causing long-term detriment to the health of the European economy. Most indicators, I'm afraid, are still negative. Austerity has inhibited growth. It's increasing unemployment. And I don't really see an optimistic path ahead.
But if we don't impose the austerity measures, what would that mean? That means the budget deficit would persist, and these indebted nations would pile on more debt. And you can't solve the problem of debt and consumption with more debt and consumption, right?
No, but you don't impose a very harsh austerity program only. You do not reduce debt necessarily with austerity and nothing else. Long-term measured austerity, yes, but there needs to be short-term financial stimulus as well.
But where do they get the stimulus? The bond market
down by increasing revenues. If we put this into a corporate context, we don't simply return to profitability by cutting costs. We keep cutting costs. It doesn't mean our revenues are going to increase.
All right, we're 4 minutes in.
It's very short-sighted and simplistic, and it's failed miserably. All indicators point to failure.
Well, that's not the case. When you cut the government spending, what that means that is that it liberates the private sector, right? The
not
private sector doesn't have to support this gigantic government.
Okay, okay, gentlemen. And we need to listen to Uri. Across Europe, there is a growing resistance to austerity. So is that Europe is now entering the most dangerous period, waiting for the reforms to deliver? Because one senior official said from the EU said if growth does not return in 2 years, all better off. So do you agree?
Well, I agree that if growth doesn't return in 2 years, then the political situation will become more and more difficult, and indeed all bets are off. However, I do believe that there is a healing process going on in Europe. This healing process takes mainly the form of improved competitiveness of the periphery, which had become very uncompetitive. You are seeing labor costs come down, you're seeing inflation slow, and you're seeing gradually some improvement in the export picture, which is absolutely, absolutely essential. I am very disappointed that, as our friend from Nottingham is, that we are not yet seeing a significant change in the growth picture. However, I am hopeful that in the course of the next year or so, certainly by the second half of 2014, we will be beginning to see the shoots of recovery. Ireland is one country where we already are anticipating growth this year. So Ireland seems to be emerging. And Portugal and Italy actually are not doing too badly. Spain and Greece are really in the midst of a depression still now.
Okay.
But so long as the competitiveness improves and the central bank, the European Central Bank remains supportive, I think there is hope that we can pull out of this.
And Cao Chan, last week the European Central Bank just cut its interest rate to a new record low of 0.5%. So why did ECB take this measure at this moment?
Well, I think the ECB is under a lot of pressure because these a lot of countries in the periphery, like Greece, they are asking Germany to ease the pressure on land to implement these austerity measures. So on the fiscal side, there's not much room for land to stimulate. So a lot of pressure is put on the ECB to do some monetary easing policy. And I agree with Yuri that these countries on the periphery have shown some signs of growth, and that is precisely because of the austerity measures. You know, why is the euro appreciating against the dollar? You know, 2 years ago, euro was in danger of collapsing. You know, it almost fell to parity with the dollar. Now, the euro is appreciating again. So why does investors show more confidence for the euro? That's because, you know, investors, you know, can appreciate the sound fiscal policies implemented by a lot of these countries. If these countries follow the path proposed by Mike, well, the euro would have already collapsed.
Mike, rebuttal?
Interesting point. Yeah, I'm afraid I still don't follow this rosy picture that Cao Chan is painting. The interest rate cut smacks
future. I'm just saying that they're dealing with the problem now.
Yeah, the interest rate from 0.75% to 0.5% is complete panic. That's because the situation is worsening, and it's not going to create confidence. It's going to create a greater lack of confidence. Just take one indicator, Europe's composite PMI is still very, very weak. It's way below the 50 threshold. Was for March, was for April this year. I mean, that's a key indicator of business confidence, business activity. Budget deficits may have come down slightly, but debt to GDP ratios have increased. And in the UK, even the budget deficit is still increasing. You cut government spending, you inhibit growth, you reduce your revenues, and you increase unemployment.
Okay, so Mike, so do you think that the American economy is doing really well? Because the American government is doing a lot of stimulus, you know, $1 trillion budget deficit per annum. So is the American economy your ideal model of the growth economy?
The ideal way forward is short-term stimulus with money well spent in infrastructure projects, on essential services, and long-term management of government debt, most definitely. But just coming to the key point that nobody's mentioned here, all this has emerged from the financial crisis. Why did that happen? That was reckless deregulation of financial markets and services and a greed culture in the banking sector where risks were became exponential and they weren't checked. And nothing has really changed in that respect. That's what really needs to be addressed by central governments, by individual Eurozone member country governments as well.
Okay, 2 points. I have a problem with the term short term. You know, they always talk about stimulating short term, right? And then cut the budget deficit medium term. But you see, the Federal Reserve has always talked about this for a long time. First of all, they talk about extended period of low interest rate, and then they always kick the can down the road. I mean, when would you get to a point where you say, okay, now's the time to get the budget deficit under control? You can't always postpone the pain, right?
Yeah, but you don't seem to accept the fact that reducing your deficit necessarily means cutting costs, and cutting costs alone. It means increasing revenues as well. And cutting costs can and are reducing revenues, reducing GDP revenues, increasing unemployment, which increase government spending.
But we don't want
a simplistic approach.
We don't want a lot of employment in government, right? Because a lot of government jobs are inefficient. A lot of bureaucrats, they collect big paychecks, but they don't produce a lot of useful goods and services.
Mike,
Chao-Chan, hang on. I got to get in here because I got to keep this sucker under control. Otherwise, the fur is going to continue flying for the rest of the hour. And there's a lot of other specific things that we do need to address. And one of these issues that you guys have been bouncing back and forth on, and I want to get to, and I want to really ask Yuri about, is something that he mentioned, which is what he saw, is the general moving forward of the European economy. And I wanted to ask myself the question, you say, Yuri, that you're seeing it move forward, but slowly at this point. But how much of that is actually... is that Europe's own volition comparative to what's actually happening in the global economy? I mean, how much is Europe actually helping itself out right now, given the fact that it is so dependent on the international, trading platform, the United States, China, Asia? You know, I mean, how much of this is actually Europe's own doing right now?
Yeah, well... I mean, the European economy, as you know, is seeing is very much in recession, and overall GDP aggregate for the whole of Europe is hardly moving, and it continues to decline in the periphery. So we need to be clear about that. When I said that things are gradually improving, I was referring to the fact that the periphery is slowly becoming more competitive. And I see the loss of competitiveness over the last 10 years or more since the euro was created as being at the heart of the crisis. So the solution of the crisis in the end will lie in competitiveness. Now, is Europe doing enough to help itself? The answer is no, in my view, although it is doing a lot more than it was doing a couple of years ago. Fundamental has been the Draghi statement that they will do whatever they need to do in order to support the governments of the countries in trouble. That was a major turning point back last summer. However, are they doing enough? No. I think that Most importantly, the center of Europe, particularly Germany, should be doing more to reflate its economy and, you know, allow wages to rise and so on and so forth. And the European Central Bank could probably also be more aggressive with its quantitative easing. Finally, one point I want to make to both my colleagues here who are on the panel with me is that, you know, you cannot talk about austerity in the abstract. There is definitely, in my view, too much austerity in Germany, and they need to change and adopt a different approach. But it's actually very difficult to do anything but austerity in a country like Italy or Spain, very simply, because markets will not lend them the money. They're just not going to finance their budget deficits. And these economies, Spain and Italy, are large enough that there's very little that other countries can do to help them. They have to regain the confidence of the markets, and that's why they are forced into cutting back government spending, because they have no alternative but to reduce their deficit. It's a tough medicine, but unfortunately, that's the only possibility now. Now, if the market situation did improve in a significant way and confidence returned, they could probably practice more expansionary policies. But I don't think they have much room for maneuver now.
All right. And on that very note, I'm glad you brought up a specific economy in the European Union, because when we come back here on today on Beyond Beijing, I want to get into this, some of the specific economies and talk about what's happening in these specific countries in and outside of the Eurozone. You're listening to Today on Beyond Beijing.
Missed some of today's big debate? No need to panic. Follow us on iTunes. Just search for Today on Beyond Beijing and subscribe to have our podcast delivered to you every day.
You're listening to Today on Beyond Beijing. I'm Paul James. Today, our big debate, we're talking about the EU economy and the situation in the overall state of the economy, talking about the European Central Bank and just the basic situation when it comes to Europe's economic health in the short term, and perhaps we'll talk about the long term as well.
So, I'm Zhao Yang. Today, we are talking in the studio with Cao Can, CEO of Shengya Capital. And also joined us on the phone are Mike Bastian, researcher at Nottingham University School of Contemporary Chinese Studies, and also Uri Dadush, director of the Carnegie Endowments International Economics Program. But now we'll shift our focus to nation by nation in the European Union. So Italy is the first nation that we want to talk about. Cao Can, actually, according to the latest National Statistics Agency of Italy, its forecast of its economy will shrink by 1.4% this year. So it's a much sharper contraction than the previously forecast. So what do you think are the real problems here in Italy? Why did the agency pull down its economic forecast?
Well, Italy is really doing a lot of austerity right now, because Italy has a really big government and a lot of debt. And now Germany is very adamant in asking them to cut the debt. And to really, you know, discuss these issues, we have to understand what austerity means. I've talked about this before on this show, but I think I need to repeat it again. Austerity, we have to understand austerity for whom? Because, you know, austerity for the public sector means liberation for the private sector. So when we talk about economic growth, we have to understand, where does economic growth come from? Does it come from the public sector, or does it come from the private sector? Because if you don't do austerity on the public sector, that means the private sector, the taxpayers, would continue to have to support this gigantic government, and all the capital would be sucked in by the government. And government doesn't do a good job of stimulating economic growth, because if government is really the panacea for economic growth, Soviet Union would be the best would have the best economic performance in the world. You know, it's free market, it's entrepreneurs, it's the private sector that's the key. So if Mike is right, then you know you should migrate to Soviet Union. That would be your ideal place.
Well, actually, you know what? Let me put this to you, Mike Bastian, and I want to get your response to this. But at the same respect, I want to ask you a little bit about Italian history, because Tao-Tan, I think, makes a fairly good point in that, you know, government isn't the be-all and end-all as far as how, you know, an economy should be working. But in the same respect, Italy has had a very troubled, shall we say, political history, and that a lot of the economic foundation of that country was is based on a very large government system that was based in the European, or make that the Soviet Union. So that being said, how easy is it to make that transition to a leaner, meaner government?
Well, it's difficult. I can respond to several of these points. First of all, Italy's is still one of the richest countries in the world. It's still a member of the G8 and the G7. So let's put things into perspective. With Italy's political situation, I think the key word there is and always has been corruption and that corrupt culture. And many people for many years are predicting that that's going to lead to problems ultimately, and perhaps that's now what we're really seeing. So I think that's a real issue and change needs to happen there. But in terms of big government or small government, the most important factor is that the government actually manages the economy and keeps a very tight stranglehold over the financial sector, and that's what hasn't happened.
Yuri Dadush, let's cross over to next door in Greece. Of course, Greece has been in the news for the past at least a year now, heavily in basically every financial newspaper that you pick up. You're talking about what's happening in Greece. Are they going to go into default? I mean, this is a country that is laden with economic problems, has been for years, has had a lot of issues with unions, social problems, things of this nature. Can Greece survive? Can Greece remain part of the Eurozone?
Yes, I think it can. But I think that inevitably the rest of the Eurozone is going to have to forgive a very large part of the Greek debt. The Greeks cannot repay their enormous government debt. They don't have enough of growth potential. They don't have enough of an export sector. Their export sector is relatively small. And while they have been regaining competitiveness, wages have been coming down relative to productivity. Prices have slowed a lot in Greece. They are still some ways from fully recovering their competitiveness. As you know, the economic situation in Greece is quite disastrous at the moment, and they're basically on life support. But ultimately, in order to remain in the euro and to regain a capacity for growth, sometime after the German elections in September, serious consideration will have to be given to debt forgiveness in Greece.
That's a very good point. And the one I'm going to put to Tao-Tan here in studio is that basically any push forward for potential loan forgiveness for these indebted countries in Europe, Greece, Spain, you name it, it really comes down to Germany. Because, I mean, they're the ones who have really been pushing the austerity drive. Do you see Angela Merkel's government, if, her government remains in power, do you see her bending at all on this issue? Or is she just going to keep her foot on the neck, as it were, as far as pushing these guys to continue with the austerity drives?
Yeah, I think she will stick to her guns. She's right in asking for these austerity measures, because if she doesn't, the German taxpayers would have to bail out these indebted nations, and that would be unfair for them, right? Because the ECB, when ECB prints a lot of money and bail out these indebted nations, that devalues euro, and that devalues the purchasing power of German citizens. But I still think a lot of that would be forgiven just to allow these indebted nations to have a clean slate. That's what's happening in Cyprus, right? Because a lot of banks in Cyprus, they bought a lot of Greek debt, And now, you know, these banks suffered a haircut in those, you know, debt repayments, and those depositors also suffered a big loss. But I think, you know, it's very easy to see that, you know, whether big government or small government works. Just do some comparison. You know, the only countries in the Eurozone which are doing well are a couple of countries like, you know, Germany, Austria, Netherlands. The other countries, UK, France, Germany, Greece, Italy, they're all suffering. And what is the difference? What separates Germany, Austria from the other countries like UK and France? It's small government. Germany had a very small government. Their debt to GDP ratio is very small. They rely on the private sector to stimulate their growth, unlike UK. UK had a big government. That is why the British pound is a basket case. You know, the same thing is true for France. France has been declining for a long time. Their industrial base is gone. Why is that? Because the French people, they want a big government. It's very easy to see, you know, just within the Eurozone, right? The stark contrast in economic performance among these nations. You have to look at the government, and I think that is the key.
Yeah, well, I'm going to take a quick break here, but I will caution to say that not everyone in France wants a big government. Nearly half of the populace voted for Nicolas Sarkozy in the last election, as opposed to Francois Hollande.
I'm just stating the fact that the French has a very big government. That to GDP fair, ratio is really high.
Fair enough. Anyway, we got to take a quick break. We will come back and we'll continue talking about individual countries within the European sphere. You're listening to Today on Beyond Beijing.
Listen to us on the go by subscribing to Today on Beyond Beijing's podcast on iTunes or listen online at radio.weibo.com and search for AM 846.
The news of today, the views of tomorrow.
Today. You're listening to Today on Beyond Beijing. I'm Paul James. Our big debate today, and boy, has it been a dandy so far, we've been talking about the status of the UK economy.
And I'm Zhao Yang. Today we are talking in the studio with Cao Can, CEO of Shengya Capital. And also joined us on the phone are Mike Baston, researcher at Nottingham University School of Contemporary Chinese Studies, and also Uri Dadush, senior associate and director of Carnegie Endowment's International Economics Program. But now back to our panel discussions. Uri, actually, you are a French, so I will talk with you about France, because Europe is seems that it has moved from Greece's sovereignty debt to passing infrastructure reforms. And we just got the news that French President Hollande is unveiling a 10-year plan for the French government to invest 20 billion euros. The package will finance a range of public infrastructure. So does it mean France will now use investment to stimulate its economy?
Well, the short answer is no. France is pretty much at the limit of how much spending it can do through the government. The size of the public sector and government spending in France is one of the highest in the world. It's far higher than it is among any of the other large European economies. France has lost quite a bit of competitiveness. It's certainly not in as bad shape as, say, Spain or Ireland because of their huge housing bubbles and their overextended financial sectors. But France has pretty serious structural problems, and they have to be very careful on the fiscal side. Now, you also have to separate the hype from the reality. 20 billion euros in an economy like France over 10 years, that's 2 billion euros a year. That's peanuts, okay? It's just a very small amount of money, which, doesn't mean it cannot help a little bit here and there. But their room for maneuver in France as well is very constrained. And France so far is able to borrow in the international markets at very reasonable interest rates. But again, it has to be very careful.
And Cao Chan, how do you think is the France problem?
Well, I think the French economy has been deteriorating. It's been deteriorating for a long time. And why do I say that? You look at their trade deficit. Their trade deficit has been going up. I think they just suffered a record trade deficit several months ago. Is that right, Yuri? I think their trade imbalance is worsening.
They've been losing market share in international markets steadily. Yeah,
true, and that just shows that their industries are not as competitive as they used to be. You know, they're not. You know, and you can't blame the currency, right? Because they use the same currency, euro, just like Germany does. Well, Germany has a very strong export industry, so this shows that, you know, currency is not really the key here. And why is the French are losing their competitiveness? It's because of the very rigid labor laws, minimum wage, 35 hours per week work hour, you know, and big government, all these welfare mentality, and that's what, you know, caused the problem.
Now that and on that front, let me just put this to Mike, because Cao Chan's really been advocating this whole bad big government sort of move, I see it from two different sides, but that's just me, and I'll leave you guys to debate this. But in the same respect, I think Cao Chan has a point, and France has got this sort of really taken the whole tax and spend mentality to a new level. You saw Francois Hollande bringing in taxes of the wealthiest of 75%. I mean, how much of this then, Mike, is from a communications point of view, from you know, when the government is trying to communicate with the world, and you hear things like this, how much of a detriment is that for businesses who may be wanting to look in and invest in France?
This is an issue, and I'm in broad agreement with the other panelists that France's position is not good, and their room for maneuver is limited. But what I find encouraging about France is the rhetoric coming out of the French government is at least they're questioning the severity of these austerity measures, most of which hit the weakest and the most vulnerable in society. And in the case of taxes, again, high taxes and increasing taxation for the rich is not necessarily a bad thing. That is a good thing for the economy. That increases government revenues, which they can invest then in infrastructure projects. Can I just finish, please? And helping small business and weaker members of the society to be more economically productive. So high taxation is not necessarily a bad thing. We need to move away from this ideological dogma.
Well, taxing the rich can't stimulate economic growth. It stifles economic growth, because when you tax the rich, you're taxing the capital. The rich people don't consume much. A lot of their income are actually saved and invested. So when you take that money away, there'll be less money that are available for entrepreneurs to grow their economy. And that's why the French economy is suffering, because they are taxing the rich, they are taxing the capital, and capital is really precious today.
And if you go back to the 80s and you look at Reaganomics and Thatcher, look what happened to that. That led in economic disaster.
All right. And
beyond doubt.
And on that note,
double-digit inflation, double-digit interest rates, negative equity.
Look at the countries that are doing well.
Disaster.
Singapore, Hong Kong, all these Asian countries, they have very low corporate tax. They're attracting capital. And why is European countries a basket case? It's precisely because they're following the path that you're proposing.
Okay, hang on. Hang on, Mike. Hang on. You mentioned Thatcher, and this is a perfect segue to take us to the UK economy and what exactly is happening there. You're poised there. You're on the hot button right now, Mike. I mean, this is an economy that has been for, you know, a generation at least, a stalwart as far as Europe is concerned. However, much like every other European economy, the UK economy has been taking its lumps recently. You got the Cameron administration, though, trying to turn things around, taking a different tact than the Labour government before it. But is it working? I mean, are things turning around there as people might hope? I mean, is the average person on the street in London or elsewhere in the UK, I mean, are they happy with the direction the economy is headed?
No, the short answer is no. Not only is it not working, things are worsening. The budget deficit is increasing. This government is a particular, unique beast amongst European governments in that it has a pathological hatred of Europe and working with Europe, and a pathological hatred of the public sector and providing welfare and services for the needy. And that's what's really driving this dismantlement or destruction of public spending and public debt. And all economic indicators are negative, even though we saw very, very modest economic growth recently. The situation is worsening.
Right. And you actually proved my point, Mike, that budget deficit actually stifles economic growth, because UK, you just mentioned that the budget deficit is increasing in UK, right?
With austerity measures as well.
Well,
the austerity measures are contributing to an increase in the budget deficit.
It's not austere enough. No. Let me finish.
Yes.
The austerity measure in UK is not austere enough. It just means that the rate of growth is not as fast. The British are not growing. The British are not growing the government at the rate that they want. But still, the debt is increasing. The government is still expanding, and they're suffering. The inflation rate in UK is above 3%. It's actually above the mandate proposed by the Bank of England. So the British pound has been collapsing, not just against the dollar, but against all the currencies. The British pound is almost the weakest currency in the world. You know, it just shows the fallacy of big government. Why is the British pound collapsing? Because the Britain has been running a trade deficit. You know, and if what you suggest is right, the British should be doing very well because the budget deficit is increasing, right?
No, the budget deficit is increasing because of austerity. You don't seem to be listening to my point here. This government's measures are making things worse.
All right.
You seem to be saying they go in this direction even further and faster.
Fellas, okay, here. I'm officially throwing in the white towel into the ring when it comes to this debate over austerity versus spending, because I want to get into some more specifics talking about issues about things like industry and where we can head. And I don't want it to just be you two going back and forth about whether or not spending is good or cuts are even better. So at any rate, let's talk about another economy next door in Ireland. Ireland, of course, was really hit a number of years back by the downturn in the IT market, which is very odd because Ireland, no one would have considered Ireland to be an IT place or a place for an IT market to pop up. But lo and behold, it did, and they made a lot of money off it. But that being said, now that the IT is come to fruition as far as the big boom is concerned, I'll put it to Yuri first. I mean, what does Ireland do now? I mean, where do they go? What options do countries like Ireland, like Cyprus, like Iceland, as another example, these sort of one-trick pony economies, and when their cash cow dies, what happens to them? How do they fix it?
Well, I really don't think that Ireland and Cyprus are the same case. In the case of Cyprus, the very tough conditions on the bailout and the wiping out of the unsecured creditors and the capital controls they've had to put in really does wipe out their main industry, which is the offshore banking sector. In the case of Ireland, Ireland is actually in a lot better shape than other countries in the periphery because they have a very large export sector. This export sector is partly information technology, which is not doing badly now, and partly it's pharmaceuticals and some other high value-added products. These sectors together with other sources of foreign exchange add up to more than 100% of Irish GDP. So this is a very open export-oriented economy and has actually been able to benefit from the relatively better conditions in global markets than they are in Europe. Furthermore, a lot of the exports coming out of Ireland are originating in multinational companies whose sources of funding are, big American companies, big German companies, big Japanese, other, whose sources of funding are from outside of Ireland. So Ireland is still in difficulties because the enormity of its housing bubble and of its banking collapse, which the government had to pay for, is so great that it lingers and will linger for many years to come. But it's clearly turning the corner, and it's actually the most promising part of the periphery today.
You mentioned housing. We're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the economy in Spain, which, of course, has been absolutely devastated by a downturn in the housing sector. You're listening to Today on Beyond Beijing.
Got a comment or question for our panelists? Send us your thoughts via our Weibo. Just go to weibo.com/todayonbeyondbeijing and we'll get your ideas to our experts.
Today's words shape tomorrow's discourse.
The future starts today.
Today's talk, tomorrow's world. Today.
You're listening to Today on Beyond Beijing. I'm Paul James. In our big debate today, we are talking about the European economy and all the issues that lie therein.
And I'm Zhao Yang. Today, we are talking in the studio with Cao Can, CEO of Shengya Capital, and also joined us on the phone, Mike Bastian, researcher at Nottingham University School of Contemporary Chinese Studies, and also Uri Dadush, Senior Associate and Director of Carnegie Endowments International Economics Program.
Yeah. Now, before the break, we were talking about how the Irish economies seem to have started its way back, thanks in part to housing. And this is one area where I find very fascinating. And I want to talk to our group about Spain and the dire situation that Spain finds itself in now. Spain was doing okay. It wasn't. It was running up deficits on an annualized basis for the past 20 years or so. But it wasn't huge. I mean, it wasn't out of the realm of, crazy at that point. But then the housing bubble blew up and everyone started losing their jobs. They couldn't pay mortgages. That led to a collapse of the banking system. And we've seen the domino play out before. But Spain's economy, how do we get this economy back to a point where it's in a reasonable level? Mike Bastian, I put it to you. How does Spain pull itself out? Can it pull its pants up at this point?
Well, I think the statistic you mentioned right at the start, unemployment, which is now soared to 27%, is the key feature here. I mean, obviously, government's financial position and the overall economic position is very, very important, but that needs to be addressed, and that requires some sort of government intervention, some sort of government stimulus to encourage these people back to work and to encourage businesses to take on people and to start economic activity. The case in Spain is another example where the private sector has caused this housing bubble. This housing downturn has been caused by banks lending irresponsibly, looking for short-term profits. People borrowed too much, a bit like the subprime mortgage fiasco in the U.S. That's led to this situation. So that needs to be addressed as well.
And Cao Can, actually, unemployment issue is not only in Spain, but also it's a widespread issue across Europe. But some economists say the solution lies in the structural reforms and also in the restoration of Europe's banking system. So how do you see it? How to restore the banking system in Europe?
Right. And this actually goes back to what Mike just suggested. Mike blamed the housing bubble on the private sector. They cannot be full of fun to choose, because you have to look at why do the banks make these reckless loans? Not just to the people who buy houses, but also to these governments. It's because of the deposit insurance, and that is actually a product of government, because when government insures the deposits, depositors don't care what banks does. That created the moral hazard, because the banks can speculate on whatever products they want, whatever investments they want, because the deposits don't care. Why do depositors don't care what banks does? Because there's deposit insurance. Now, in a free market, you would not have deposit insurance. Deposit insurance is absolutely a product of government. So you have to look at the source of the problem.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying, Mike?
Mike?
Well, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were renationalized by the Bush administration. Why was that?
And Freddie Mac are also quasi-government agencies.
Doesn't work.
They're also quasi. It just shows you government doesn't work, because the Federal Reserve lowered the interest rate too low.
Why were they renationalized?
Because they want to guarantee the loans. They want
because
to get the source.
Failed. No, because their private companies failed. They behaved irresponsibly.
No, renationalized by
the Bush administration.
And that's why they failed, right? They get nationalized by the Bush administration, created this whole housing bubble, and all these agencies that cannot be repaid.
All right, fellas, let's get back on topic here. We're not talking about the U.S. economy. We're talking about the European economy. We'll leave the U.S. economy for another day, which I'm sure will be a more rousing debate. At any rate, there's a few more places that we need to talk about. We touched on the island economy of Cyprus a little bit earlier, but I want to get back into it a little bit more. Yuri Dadush, the situation in Cyprus, I mean, this is an economy that, obviously was very small and relied quite heavily on the offshore banking sector for a lot of its revenues. But that being said, is it possible that we may see this 20 billion euro loan? I mean, will that be enough to get the economy in Cyprus stimulated enough to where the government there can start to, tinker with things and get themselves back on the right track?
Well, my guess is that I don't know how you get to 20 billion, but anyway, a very large amount of money, much larger than Cyprus GDP, one way or another, is being lent to Cyprus as it restructures its completely overinflated banking sector. Cyprus is in for a very rocky and difficult road. I would not be surprised to see Cyprus GDP decline by as much or more as Greece's GDP has declined since the crisis, which is 20% or more. So Cyprus has in its prospect a prolonged depression, unfortunately. I doubt very much whether Cyprus will be able to repay these loans. Just like Greece, with GDP falling and debt exploding precisely because the bailout funds are in the form of loans to Cyprus, this is going to be a very, very bad scene. So one day, yet again, Cyprus will need debt forgiveness, in my view, just as Greece will. Mm. What is remarkable is that despite these conditions, very tough conditions, despite the wiping out of its main industry, the Cypriots appear to have decided that they're going to stick it out in the Eurozone. No serious consideration was given by the government to drop out of the Euro. I guess there you can see a little bit of positive news in that it shows you that countries will go to very, very great lengths to remain in the euro because they're afraid of the alternative, which would very likely be a meltdown of the economy and certainly a collapse of any government that attempts to take a country out of the euro.
Right. And I want to also emphasize why Cyprus is in such a lousy situation. Cyprus bought a lot of Greek debt. And when Greek government can't repay the debt, that's why the they're suffering right now. And why would Cyprus bought so much Greek debt? It's because they bought into the erroneous assumption that if Greece defaulted, there will always be a bailout from the ECB from the Germany. It's because of this moral hazard that encouraged this reckless lending. So when you take away the ECB's interference in a bond market, these banks in Cyprus would be a lot more responsible in making their lending. So that is the source of the problem. It's the moral hazard that's created. It's not the private sector, Mike.
Well, no, again, fellas, I love the debate, but there's a couple of other things I want to get in here before the clock hits 11. So, Mike, speaking of the what Uri was mentioning about the Cyprus deciding to stay in the Eurozone, this brings me to a bigger question, which is, what about some of the countries that are outside the Eurozone but have expressed an interest in getting in potentially, like Poland? Poland and some of these other Eastern European economies which are starting to come through. I mean, if I'm Poland and I'm looking at the situation in the Eurozone right now, I'm going, oh, I ain't touching that with a 10-foot cattle prod at this point. But that being said, I mean, is it possible we may see an expansion of the Eurozone still?
I think that's possible. I think these countries will still want to enter because they can see the benefits in terms of trade liberalization, a single currency, and that will help them in the long term. But I think what will happen is a consolidation amongst the big powers in Europe and a requirement to manage the budget deficits of individual member nations much more closely. So I don't think we'll see an expansion in the short term. As for Cyprus' position, I think it is very, very dire, but I would just make the point it's an overinflated banking sector, which is largely privately owned, that has caused this problem.
And Uri, actually, today we talk about the EU economy. So from your perspective, where does the economic recovery in Europe really need to come from? Should it be coming from the EU as a group or individual nation states?
Well, again, as I said before, I think the EU can do more to help itself through deflation in Germany and probably some more, even more aggressive policies of expansion by the European Central Bank, although they've really shifted quite a bit over the last couple of years in that direction. Where will the growth come from in Europe? Well, absolutely critical is that the U.S. economy continues to recover and that the emerging markets continue to grow, because at the heart of Europe's problem is the fact that the periphery has just become completely uncompetitive under the euro. And the periphery, in order to grow again, needs a return to confidence by the markets, etc. That's why, inevitably, they're going to have to cut government deficits and show the markets that they're in reasonable shape. And but the other big part of the recovery in the periphery has to be regaining, gaining share again in these fast-growing markets around the world, particularly the emerging markets. That's a very important part of the solution to Europe's problems, and that's also a reason why it would help to have more inflation in Germany and a more expansive, even more expansive monetary policy by the European Central Bank, because Europe also needs a lower euro. And that would also help the periphery a lot.
All right, we're almost out of time. I want to put the final question to Cao Chan here in studio, and that is from our point of view sitting here in Beijing. If you're in Zhongnanhai and you're looking at what's going on right now in the European Union, do you invest? I mean, do you buy bonds that emanate from the Eurozone? I mean, is Europe still a reasonable bet?
Right. This is really not a simply economic question. It's really a strategic question. Because I don't think the Chinese buy European debt just for economic returns. I think the reason why China made a lot of investment in Europe is that China wants to see an alternative to the U.S. dollar.
Of course,
they want to support the euro so that so that there will be more choices for the investors. So, but I think China cannot support euro forever because China has its own problems to deal with, and China has done its part by buying a lot of European debt at the height of the crisis 2 years ago. And that's why the bond yield has actually gone down significantly, because investors believe that China will always backstop these indebted European nations. And I think, both China and Germany are proposing the same thing, that you need to get your budget deficit under control. And they're setting a good example. China has just proposed that, we're going to cut a lot of government ourselves. We're going to reduce the amount of administrative items that require administrative approvals. We're going to reduce government interference in the free market. You look at economies that are doing well, they're all proposing the same thing, which is small government.
All right, you got the last word in over Mike Bastian in that respect. That's all the time we have for our great debate. Thanks to all our guests in studio with us, Cao Zhen, CEO of Shangya Capital, on the phone with us, Mike Bastian, researcher at Nottingham University School of Chinese Studies, and Yuri Dadu, senior associate and director of the Carnegie Endowment International Economics Program. We're going to come back with all of our top news of the day. Thanks for being with us in our first hour. You're listening to Today on Beyond Beijing.